Thank you.
I'd just like to start with some words of gratitude, especially to Jane Ellen for inviting me here, and also just the general welcoming atmosphere I've experienced since I've started coming here a few months ago. Thank you. It's a beautiful space. I'd also like to ask you to kind of ignore the title of this talk. It's like not truth in advertising. I wrote it several months ago. The talk has evolved since then. You'll probably find glimmers of chaplaincy as refuge in uncertain times in this talk, but I'm gonna be talking about some different things, I guess, today. So there's this country music song called Friends in Low Places. Apparently it's by Garth Brooks. I listened to it yesterday and survived, I guess. I thought of its existence as I was writing this talk because a year ago I graduated from Zen Buddhist chaplaincy training at Upaya Zen Center, which is in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And a common theme of this whole experience, a two-year training, was talk of charnel grounds. We were often told, especially by Roshi Joan Halifax, who's the founder and abbot of Upaya, that chaplaincy involved going to the charnel grounds of life on this planet. What is a charnel ground? The internet tells me it is an above-ground site where human bodies are left to decompose, often consumed by animals or scavengers, serving as a powerful raw site for meditating on impermanence in Buddhist and Hindu traditions. It acts as a metaphor for confronting fear, death, and the chaotic nature of reality. Roshi Joan reveled in this metaphorical usage as she urged us to take our chaplaincy to low places, to places of suffering, which are of course ubiquitous in our world. And so today I'd like to talk about some of the joy and discovery I have found in low places, most notably in the carceral system, where I have been doing my chaplaincy work as the organizer of a small group of volunteers teaching meditation and yoga at the women's prison, SCI Cambridge Springs. I will partially do this through the lens of Dogen Zenji's work, The Tenzo Kyokun, or Instructions to the Cook. While the 13th century founder of Japanese Soto Zen is better known for his masterwork, The Shobogenzo, or Treasury of the True Dharma Eye, The Tenzo Kyokun provides a guide to the work of the temple cook, which Dogen transformed from a potentially lowly task to the highest manifestation of Dharma practice. I'd like to also briefly note that the work of the kitchen is, of course, usually gendered as female, unless done in elite fashion as a chef, which tends to be gendered male. In a monastery of male monks, of course, a male person will be the temple cook. And Dogen wrote Tenzo Kyokun partially as an instruction manual and partially as an exhortation to regard this position as one that should be carried out in the bodhisattva spirit, or the spirit of someone who has pledged their life to serve the awakening of all beings. In Tenzo Kyokun, Dogen emphasizes that serving as the temple cook should be done using three different minds. First is daishin, or magnanimous mind, literally in Japanese, large mind. Second, kishin, or joyful mind. And third, roshin, or nurturing mind, literally parental mind. I'd like to talk about chaplaincy practice here today in terms of these three minds. My own interest in chaplaincy began as a really selfish interest to study Zen Buddhism, and a wider one in wanting to find ways to think about and act upon the crisis of loneliness and disconnection in our culture, as well as the ecological crisis. My day job is as a political science professor, and I felt increasingly both afraid and enraged about the polarization and lack of compassion characterizing our politics in this country. At the same time, as someone raised and still identifying as Jewish, I resonate with the imperative to tikkun olam, or repair the world. I'd first like to introduce the carceral setting in the United States and some of my experience with it. The United States has less than 5% of the world's population, but 25% of its prisoners. About 2% of the US population is in some way under the control of the carceral state, either in prison or on probation or parole. 62% of now incarcerated women have a child under the age of 18. One advocate on behalf of the incarcerated notes that to be imprisoned is to suffer a kind of social death in relation to separation from family and other communities of support, and in relation to subjection to violence and humiliating treatment. This is probably the most striking dimension of serving in a prison, seeing and experiencing a part of our country that is mostly invisible to the outside world. Gaining access to the prison is a bureaucratic and seemingly often arbitrary process, dependent on the whims of its authorities. Unlike an actual charnel ground, which is public in its exposure of death to the community, a prison is a highly private and regulated space, despite its being paid for by our tax dollars. This is probably for the benefit of the privacy of the incarcerated, but also so that we are not necessarily aware of what sorts of conditions are being created in our name. The act of incarcerating people is a kind of social death for them, and our society does not do much better for them after they are done serving their sentences. It is a low place designed to minimize the humanity of those who reside there. A few snapshots of my time there, first as an intern with the prison chaplain, and then as a volunteer. Learning that 85% of inmates entering the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections report being abused at some point in their lives. Learning that during the total solar eclipse of 2024, the facility was placed on lockdown so the correctional officers could enjoy viewing it while the inmates were in their cells. Doing a totally typical internship task of shredding papers, but these were death notices that the chaplain's office delivered to inmates. A brother shot to death, a sister who committed suicide, many, many overdose deaths of mothers and fathers and sons and daughters, a husband killed in a car accident, a daughter shot to death, a grandson shot to death. Writing sympathy notes on behalf of the prison chaplain to inmates who have suffered these sorts of losses in their lives, including one that haunts me today, to an inmate whose 13-year-old child died of hypothermia after running away from her foster home, where she was because her mother was incarcerated. Visiting an 80-year-old inmate who had been in prison for 40 years and living in the prison infirmary, hoping to get her sentence commuted, and in the end it wasn't, but if she didn't get her sentence commuted, saying she'd rather die in prison with the people who love me. So to talk first about magnanimous or big mind, Dogan notes that this is like a mountain, stable and impartial, exemplifying the ocean. It is tolerant and views everything from the broadest perspective. Having a magnanimous mind means being without prejudice and refusing to take sides. To some extent, this aligns with the Zen principle or vow of not knowing, which is something I love in theory, but as a recovering academic struggle with in practice. One of my favorite Zen koans, which are puzzles or teaching stories from ancient Chinese masters in the tradition, is case 20 from the Book of Serenity, in which Dizang asks Fa Yan where he was going. And Fa Yan replied he was on a pilgrimage. Dizang asked the purpose of this, and Fa Yan said, "I don't know." Dizang replied, "Not knowing is most intimate." Upon hearing this, Fa Yan was said to have immediately experienced enlightenment. I have moments like this sometimes with the students in the prison. One time I was asking them about their experience of nature in the prison. There was a dogwood tree that at the time was blooming beautifully, as they tend to do. In spring 2023, I asked them, "Have you seen the dogwood tree?" And they were like, "Of course we have seen the dogwood tree." Their innate wisdom. Because honestly, I myself only became aware of when dogwoods bloom well into middle age. But by the following year, the tree had been cut down. I asked them about this. They said, "We can't have anything nice." Another conversation, inmate asked me about karma. She said, "Can I ask you a question about karma? Do you think being in prison is a manifestation of karma? I did something that resulted in the death of someone else." It's humbling and hard to even begin to know what to say when faced with these sorts of conversations. And instead of sharing my deeply inadequate response to her question, I'd like to share something from American Tibetan Buddhist nun Pema Chodron's classic book, When Things Fall Apart. Spiritual awakening is frequently described as a journey to the top of a mountain. We leave our attachments and our worldliness behind and slowly make our way to the top. At the peak, we have transcended all pain. The only problem with this metaphor is that we leave all the others behind. Our drunken brother or schizophrenic sister, our tormented animals and friends. Their suffering continues, unrelieved by our personal escape. In the process of discovering bodhicitta, the open heart mind, the journey goes down, not up. It's as if the mountain pointed toward the center of the earth instead of reaching into the sky. Instead of transcending the suffering of all creatures, we move toward the turbulence and doubt. Right down there in the thick of things, we discover the love that will not die. Since we're getting heavy here, I thought we'd talk next about Kishin, or joyful mind. Dogen writes of the gratitude that the Tenzin should feel at the opportunity to serve. Considering the innumerable possibilities in a timeless universe, we have been given a marvelous opportunity. The merit of working as a Tenzo will never decay. Every time I am with the inmates at SCI Cambridge Springs, we laugh together. Just this past week, the phone rang in the room in the middle of our meditation. It was like one of those really old-fashioned phones that ring with a phone ring, and one of the inmates says, "It's 1986 calling." One sample exchange in our weekly check-in. "Inmate, I'm having a tough relationship with my pillow. We may be breaking up." Same inmate the next week. "I want to report that I've reconciled with my pillow and I feel good about sticking with the relationship." Interestingly, at least for me, the Blue Cliff Record, another set of koans, features a koan where a Zen master is asked why the Bodhisattva Guanyin has thousands of hands and eyes and replies, "It's like someone in the night reaching behind her for a pillow." Our meditation class used to take place in a room next to the facility's gym, and it actually now takes place in the gym itself. Once there was a dance class as they were meditating, to which one of the other volunteers noted, "We probably shouldn't call this silent meditation," to which the inmate responded, "We were silent." There was also an incident involving the song Baby Shark, which is a story that's Jennifer Hellworth's to tell. Finally, I'd like to talk about Roshan, or nurturing mind. How to support those living with these sorts of restrictions as they seek to live in the present. And here is where I think Zen and meditation have something distinctive to offer. Roshi Joan Halifax, one of my teachers, who has also worked with men on death row in New Mexico, talks about interacting with incarcerated men. She says, "I can't tell prisoners that every moment is wonderful. This is simply not true, not in prison." Some who study teaching meditation in prison advise that inmates should be educated regarding the injustices of their situation, as if they are not already well aware of this. Instead, I think chaplaincy can offer a few approaches to being nurturing, which we can perhaps also apply in our own daily stressful lives in these unprecedented times. And I feel like these are all examples of magnanimous as well as nurturing mind. First, the value of community. We offer our meditation and yoga class to anyone who can come, but they have to be choosy in the prison because they are only permitted to do one activity per week. So, for instance, they have to choose between going to meditation or going to the gym. We have a waiting list now of some 20 people who would like to join our group, which is about a dozen people. And I want to serve as many as possible while also noting that we haven't achieved an intimacy with each other over our 2 years together that might be altered with new folks joining. It has become a little prison sangha, and there is love and joy in the room together. Second, attitude. While many advising those working with the incarcerated to be cautious regarding their potential for manipulation, a chaplain can model values of non-hierarchy, intimacy, and friendship, exactly by not making assumptions of the inmates as somehow wrong or broken. And I'd like to say this could also be applied to those with whom we disagree politically or theologically, but it's hard these days. But we can at least always try to remember and act out of a sense of shared humanity. Finally, intentions, seeing all people, especially the incarcerated, in their full humanity. Once at a volunteer banquet, I connected with an inmate in the food line who, when I asked, "How are you doing?" she replied, "I can't complain." And I said, "Well, you can if you want, to me." She laughed and seemed somewhat happy in that moment. Partially, sometimes we have to just give people permission to feel complex emotions, to not have to pretend to be happy all the time. Zen practice brings the idea of Buddha nature or basic goodness, which is so different from the identity label of convicted felon or sinner or even incarcerated person. Buddhist scholar Stephen Batchelor writes of how any person is just an unfinished project. On that note, I'd like to close with a poem by the noted Jewish Buddhist Leonard Cohen from Book of Mercy. And I'd like, given my feminist claim earlier, I'd like to apologize a bit for its chosen pronoun. In the eyes of men he falls, and in his own eyes too. He falls from his high place. He trips on his achievement. He falls to you. He falls to know you. It is sad, they say. See his disgrace, say the ones at his heel. But he falls radiantly toward the light to which he falls. They cannot see who lifts him as he falls or how his falling changes. And he himself bewildered till his heart cries out to bless the one who holds him in his falling. And in his fall, he hears his heart cry out. His heart explains why he is falling, why he had to fall, and he gives over to the fall. Blessed are you, clasp of falling. He falls into the sky. He falls into the light. None can hurt him as he falls. Blessed are you, shield of falling. Wrapped in his fall, concealed within his fall, he finds his place. He is gathered in. While his hair streams back and his clothes tear in the wind, he's held up, comforted. He enters into the place of his fall. Blessed are you, embrace of the falling, foundation of the light, master of the human accident. Thank you so much.